Mark Steiner, welcome back. We are talking with Faith Boshin, who is a MICA student, Maryland Institute College of Arts. She's a sophomore, we just learned, working on a project to memorialize every homicide victim in Baltimore with a teddy bear. Next week, on Wednesday night, from at 6 to 7 p.m., Wednesday, May 13th, at the NAACP branch office at 8 West 26th Street, there'll be Voices Against Violence 2, which is something you should be involved in as much as you can. And you can join us here at 410-319-8888 to talk with Faith Boshin. And Faith, when we were on break, you said that one of your main, you went to school for the arts, which I was not surprised
yes.
to hear, and that one of your main concentration areas is in video, and you're also making a documentary of this work.
Yeah, well, in Baltimore School for the Arts, I just did visual art, and video wasn't offered to us, but when I was a freshman, when I started my freshman year, I chose video as my elective, and now it's going to be my concentration, and photo is going to be my major.
So tell me about these teddy bears. What are they made of? How are you making them? Or what are you doing?
I'm not making
them. Okay, what are you doing?
It's more of an installation with found bears.
With found bears.
I wanted them all to be used. So I found them from friends, from family, and from thrift stores around the city. So I've just been buying out all their bears. And now my house is filled with tons of teddy bears of all sizes.
What does it feel like? I was thinking about this as you were mentioning that. I was wondering what it feels like for you as a young woman with a kind of a deep consciousness about this, and you obviously feel about the young people and the people who have been murdered in this city and how tragic and huge that is, that you have all these teddy bears that surround you in your home that you're about to install around the street corners of Baltimore where people have been murdered. And in some senses, you look at those teddy bears, I can see kind of you feeling like there's a soul inside of them, like this. They're representing somebody who is here but is gone.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, they're representing someone that I may not know, but they're still living in the same city. So there might have been a time where I'd passed them and you know, we just didn't meet each other. And also I was talking to Dr. Chi then about his rallies and how he used to have rallies and he would see faces just pass by. And then in other rallies, he would see that those same faces in the rallies because people that they knew and loved died.
So how did you and Doc Cheatham from the NAACP hook up in all this? How'd that happen? Tell me about that story.
When I was thinking about my proposal for my project, my mom was seeing signs, flyers around for these rallies called Stop the Violence.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me, why don't you make this piece public? And I was thinking about it. So she looked it up online and I found a phone number and it said, call if you want to know how you can help.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called that number right away and it was Dr. Cheatham. I left a message and I said, I need a location for this project. That's all I needed was a location, just somewhere where it could go and stay so that people who passed by could see it. And he called me back the next day after a teacher had told me, don't get your hopes up. And so I didn't get my hopes up, but it happened. He called me back and he was like, I'm really excited about this. I want to bring the press and I want to make this a big event and I want to do a rally. And I was like, oh my goodness.
You weren't expecting all that, were you?
No, I was not expecting that at all.
Well, Doc Cheatham is up. I mean, he's a deeply committed man. I'm not surprised he called. If I had heard that you called him, I would have told you that Doc is going to call you back. I mean, he's, you know, that this is, his passion is the people of this city, and your project probably really grabbed him by the heart. So I'm sure he called you back.
It really did. I was just about to say that because when I talked to him, he was just so excited. I just can't explain it. I got it on video, though.
You got it on video?
When he was just talking about it. Yeah, and he said it's a perfect time for something like this to happen because he does a lot of the rallies.
Yep.
And
yep.
He just loved to see a fresh new young face. That's what he said.
That's
and
cool.
So here I am.
The fresh new young face.
Yeah.
Well, no, but I think that there's something you represent that goes beyond you, which is I feel there's an energy among a lot of the young people. I was with on the night that Barack Obama won the election. One of my little family members, Alana, is a senior or junior at MICA right now. And she had all of her MICA friends there who had worked for Obama. And they were sitting around my other daughter's living room and we were watching the results. And these young people from MICA were just so profoundly moved. And many of them were African-American and Asian-American kids. And they were just completely moved by this scene, and they were all socially active. And you give the rest of us hope because you're out there believing that the struggle makes sense. We can make a better world.
Yeah, the thing that's great about art is this, you can just put it up, and it really does move a lot of people, because a lot of people, they think visually, and like I do. And yeah, when Barack won, we were all out on the streets, and we were celebrating with pots and pans, and I could hear firecrackers, and it was just a great experience. I heard that out in the county, you could just hear the city just going wild.
You were one of them.
So I was one of them.
You voted?
I did vote.
Your first election?
Yes, my first election, and it was a good one, and I'm glad about the turnout.
So talk about, before we have to take a break and go to Barry Levinson, the film festival, what where these are going to be. Where are you going to install all these teddy bears? Where are they going to go?
Well, they're going to go outside the NAACP building. There's a railing there right in front of the door, and it's sort of shaped like maybe a half circle. And there's a banner there. We're going to take it down, and we're going to hang them up on these the iron rods, sort of like, you know, a staircase, and then there's a railing. And that's basically the railing, but it's metal. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to hang them up with wire there. And then after the rally, I'm going to donate them to St. John's Hospital, and they're going to keep them. So it's sort of my gift, and they're going to stay there, and they're going to be dry, and so they won't get wet.
Oh, that's brilliant. So they're not going to necessarily go to the locations where people were shot and killed. They're going to be...
Well, that was my initial idea, mm-hmm. was to put them in every location. But I talked to Dr. Teethan about it, and he thought it was a really good idea to put them all together so that the rally could go along with the installation. And
when is that going to take place, the installation?
That I'm going to install it on Wednesday earlier, before 6, and 6 on the 13th, before 6... I'm going to install it all, and then we're going to reveal it when people get there.
That's just wonderful. I just think that this is, you have raised me up today.
I'm glad.
Spiritually, it's been wonderful to have you here. Faith Boshin is a student at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's a sophomore. She's working this project to memorialize every homicide victim in Baltimore with a teddy bear that will be outside the NAACP headquarters. And remind you that next week, she's talking about Wednesday, May 13th, Voices Against Violence 2, 6 to 7 p.m. At the NAACP branch at 8 West 26th Street. And Faith, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks for having
Thanks
me.
Thanks for coming
nice
on
to meet
today.
You too.
Pleasure. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. We come back. Barry Levinson, the great film director, is going to be here talking about Pollywood. And we'll learn more about the Maryland Film Festival. So stay with us to hear that conversation we had with him this week. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to the Mark Steiner Show, which is brought to you by MeetCube, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeetCube was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. Over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. This weekend is the Maryland Film Festival, a great yearly event where you get a chance to see some of the great independent films that most likely won't be coming to your local Hoyts or Regal cinemas. This year you have a lot to choose from social documentaries to great dramatic work featuring unknown actors and famous stars like Robin Williams. One of the films you'll get a chance to see this year is Pollywood, the new documentary from Academy Award-winning director and hometown boy Barry Levinson. I had a chance to sit down with Barry Levinson and Maryland Film Festival director Jed Dietz to learn about Pollywood and why you should see it. First, let's listen to the introduction of the film.
My first recollection of television is it came into our house. It was wrapped in paper with a big bow on it. I don't think anybody realized the profound changes that television would bring about.
Television?
In Avalon, I covered the subject. I showed how we went from this large extended family to ultimately this small nuclear family sitting at TV trays watching television, watching an American family on television. I've always had a love-hate relationship with television. I worked in it. I did all the kinds of jobs, everything from a floor director to writing and directing television. And I don't think anyone could possibly have envisioned the changes that would have taken place and the effects that television had on us. It certainly has changed politics, the nature of so-called celebrity, and it's probably changed us in many ways that we still have yet to understand.
That's television.
Joining me in the studio here at this moment is Jed Dietz, who is the founder and director, is that your title, of the Maryland Film Festival. We're talking with Barry Levinson, one of America's great filmmakers and directors, who obviously we all know comes out of Baltimore and has made this new documentary called Pollywood, which will be shown at the festival. And Jed, good to see you. And Barry, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good to be here.
So Pollywood, when we last saw each other and you were in the studio with me, you were talking about this documentary that you were going to make because you followed the Creative Coalition to two national conventions, Republican and Democrats, and then you also went to inauguration. So talk about the genesis of this and how this, what is the Creative Coalition, how you, why you decided to start shooting what they were doing?
Well, I mean, it wasn't even really quite following that, but Robin Brown from the Creative Coalition said, look, we're going there, and we're going to be at both conventions, and there's going to be a lot of politicians, and, you know, it's a, it'll be a rather, you know, fascinating, you know, mix. You know, we'd love you to shoot, you know, some footage. And I said, specifically what? She says, well, whatever you want to, you know, do. It just seemed like it might be an interesting time. So there wasn't any kind of mandate, and I didn't have any preconceived ideas about what I wanted to do, so I just started filming and then letting things happen. And then things began to evolve. And then the idea about the media and how prevalent it is became a big issue in the documentary ultimately.
There were so many layers to this thing, the way you shot it and the questions you asked and what came out of these conversations. I was really fascinated by the kind of all the points you attempted to and did touch during the film. And the notion of celebrity and of celebrity being attached to but detached from regularly, quote unquote, regular human beings, I thought was a really kind of interesting discussion, the way it took place, whether it was you and your interactions with Matthew Modine and your conversations with, is that right, Matthew Modine? Yeah, Matthew, and your conversations with, what they had with Republican delegates. That, it's a, such a complex thing, and it kind of, you approach it in a really kind of different way, I think.
Well, I mean, I was just trying to bring it to, you know, we live in extremely complicated times in terms of communication because we're almost overwhelmed by the amount of information and misinformation that comes at us. And, you know, because we look at this television, anything on the television almost has equal importance. And it has a tendency to polarize us at the same time. And I kind of follow that so that we suddenly get put in these boxes of being to the left, to the right, to being a conservative, to being a liberal. And I try to, like, show how that works and how we suddenly, you know, join and pick sides and how this polarization is being extremely detrimental to us and the times we're in.
In that notion of celebrity, I mean, one of the things that was interesting in the conversation with Modine that comes out, I think people forget is that, and I think you said it as well in the film, that all these people who are known to us because they're either directors or on the screen and you see their faces all the time, so you know who they are when they walk down the street, they all started out as poor or middle-class kids. They all had
yes.
to struggle to get where they are.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that but happens is that, you know, celebrities, and it's really, the piece doesn't try to defend or attack. But what happens is we look at a lot of times now because of the way it's been portrayed that celebrities are an elitist group. And then you suddenly look into that and you say, well, like Matthew Modine comes from Utah, from a poor family of seven. So-and-so grew up in Kansas. This one comes from Minnesota. You know, everybody comes from these kind of very much middle-class or blue-collar backgrounds mm-hmm. from all over the country. And because they had certain talents and the nature of our country that ultimately you can aspire to things and accomplish that dream, and they are a products of what is so great about America, then there are those who will attack them as if they have no connection to the common man. The reality is they came from that place.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's a strange paradox, but when you manipulate media enough, you can create that concept. And that's one of the things that we try to look at and show how these things come about in the course of this 85-minute documentary.
And in doing that, one of the things that was their sit down with Republican delegates. One thing I was really struck by was the hostility.
Yes, because the woman who is very, very angry, basically says, you people, you elitist people, you don't understand what it's really like. You don't understand, us.
There is a level of arrogance in Hollywood that we can't stand. You guys think that you know everything, that you have all the answers, that you speak for us. You do not. You don't speak for the general America. I'm always shocked at how you guys view the world. You live in such a small, isolated community. You're not the normal America. When you own 8 homes, when you make multi-millions, when you have agents and camera people and cosmetic people constantly building you up and yesing you all the time, you guys don't get what it's like. And then you come at us and say, you don't think like the rest of the country, and you belittle us. You belittle us and you demean us because we don't think like you do. So therefore, we're stupid. We're stupid Americans out there, and that's just not fair.
And what comes about, because that's the attitude that she sort of has embraced, and then when they actually start talking to one another, in this case Tim Daly starts talking to her, all of a sudden these kind of barriers come down, and the next thing you know, they can actually talk to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is, more often than not, we are more similar than we are different. But we have created these walls that are of separation, and that's the detrimental part. Mostly, we can agree, as it actually happens there, because in the documentary, it starts rather hot. This woman is so angry at actors, etc. And then the more they begin to talk, the more they actually share common interests. And that's part one of it, is that with the world that is so full of interaction of media, how communication has gotten out of whack and how easy it is for us to really not communicate.
And the mediums you talk about here, I don't know how the film ended up, but in the cut that I saw, where you began with scenes from Avalon and your face kind of in a black and white tube talking about what TV has done, what the media has done, and then your conversations reporter from MSNBC, who's, I'm blocking on his name, I apologize.
Lawrence O'Donnell?
Yes, Lawrence O'Donnell, that conversation.
Jim Lehrer is holding up the public service aspect of it, and the rest of us are desperately chasing ratings in the same way that American Idol is, with all the same values. It's been a one-way street. There's been no reversal in the phenomenon that you can point to. All of the desks we've expanded to here, beyond those three network news anchors, very much concentrate on entertainment and opinion and character, and they are trying to get you to fall in love with the star of this show, the character who they've put as the star of this show, just like any primetime entertainment series. The repercussions of that is that you have to be very much more careful about your consumption of news, because now the target is ratings. It is simply ratings. That is all it is.
And then how you ended up in another part of the film talking about how the TV itself is kind of divides us. And the closed-circuit look we have of lives that take away from that real human interaction. I mean, you seem to also be having in this, in your own way, this kind of critique of what the media, especially television, has done to us.
Yes, well, I think, what happens is, in the course of the piece, I talk about media. I allow these other scenes where people are interacting or not understanding one another. I leave those alone and don't comment. So I never really comment on the behavior that takes place within the piece. I basically comment on the nature of media and how it has created images and reality that, in fact, may not even be real. And so it kind of plays on those levels, because as it says in the documentary, once news was no longer public service and became entertainment because it has to make money, we changed the form of news. And we keep evolving it, and it continues to evolve it, and so it has to find another way to entertain in another way, because it's about the money. And at a certain point, you begin to borrow ideas from, you know, drama, etc., create mm-hmm. conflict, and all of a sudden you put somebody from the left, from the right, and you let them argue, and people, that becomes the form. I was talking to a lawyer not long ago, and he goes on television periodically, and he said he was in the green room one time and with the other lawyer, and he said, so what side do you want to take? Well, they'll argue either side. You know?
That says it all.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Go ahead, Jed.
Well, and I was so interested in your discussions in the film, you know, about how many of these labels and these media motivations just distract us from what the big issues are. You know, we can find ourselves a whole lot of time completely getting all caught up in some issue that has really nothing to do with
right.
the things really facing mm-hmm. the nation.
No, I mean, take one that's just recent. That's not in a documentary. But take recently that, you know, Obama went to Latin America and they had those conferences, and then it was the photograph of him and Chavez.
Right.
And then everybody's reading into it. Well, he's not a strong enough leader, you know.
He smiled.
He's smiling in this photo. Look, he's smiling. I mean, how would you possibly figure out diplomacy from a smile? And it wasn't like, well, it's ludicrous. Next thing you know, they're talking about it for days on end. and we're like suddenly, the premise is that it's already absurd, but we have accepted the absurdity and now we'll discuss it.
I mean, there was that great part in the film where I think you were talking, I think this is when you were talking to Ellen Burstyn, who I just loved in this film. And we were talking about Winston Churchill and what would happen if Winston Churchill had made his statement of fighting them on the shores if he had done this in the 21st century rather than the 1940s.
Right, yes. Yeah, so it was Susan Sarandon and saying, you know, so the famous Churchill speech is suddenly reduced to, well, he looked a little tired, he looked like he was a little overweight. I mean, suddenly we're now commenting on his look, his dress, etc., as opposed to the nature of the speech, because that becomes one of the things we do now. And then we can divert away from the essential and focus on whatever we want to focus on.
So we're going to show this film, and then afterwards there will be a panel. Barry, of course, will be here, and Matthew Modine, who's in the film and has been very active on a number of fronts, will...
He's been here before.
Yeah, he was here with a couple of films. The film he was in, the great Stanley Kubrick, Full Metal Jacket.
That's right.
And then he's been very involved with the Wounded Warrior Project, and we had a film about a documentary about a ranger who had been severely injured in Iraq coming home. It really isn't in Iraq at all, but it was about him coming home. And Matthew had gotten very came to see that film and was very involved with that. And David Brock, who is Media Matters for America. Now, this is a guy who started on the right side of the issues, right-wing side of right. the issues, attacking Anita Hill and the Clintons as a hired gun, basically, and then wrote a book called Blinded by the Right, and has then started this website about misinformation and called Media Matters for America. So this panel will not only will we show the movie, but then afterwards there will be this panel.
That's great. That's good. So I like how that you're kind of wandering back into these documentary forms. This is
it was fun to do. You know, the upside of it is, I mean, you do it because it's actually interesting and it's sort of entertaining to do it. The downside is whenever you do something and you have like a lot of ideas in it. You're sort of always open to somebody who said, well, how come you didn't have this, or why didn't you do that? You know what I mean? So
mm-hmm.
it's a never-ending thing because there's so much that comes out of a piece like Pollywood, you know, to talk about or to argue, to discuss, to kind of think about, and which leads to the next thing, to the next thing, you know. So it's there's always a duality to certain things that are really fertile for discussion.
So I'm wondering when, as you did this film, what you came away with that maybe you didn't expect, Every time you do a film, no matter what it is, whatever you do, there's always a twist you're not expecting.
Well, I mean, I think the biggest thing that I came away with, which is one of the things that's in the movie, is that I am very fearful that we really have a difficult time knowing what's important, and it's very often that which is most important is never going to be seen because it doesn't have a visual component.
Mm-hmm.
And if I were to apply it, and let's use Maryland since we're talking down the area, is if you take, say, the Chesapeake Bay, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Chesapeake Bay is 40% dead. It is basically a disaster that's taking place.
Right.
A disaster, an economic disaster, a health disaster in terms of tourism, a disaster. And yet it is not on anyone's agenda in terms of a real high priority. You would almost think that there would be a Manhattan Project to save the bay.
Right.
But it's lost in the shuffle of all the things going on because visually it doesn't jump out at us about, oh, look, you know what I mean? Because it looks like a bay. It looks normal.
Right.
And there's no one, there is nothing that spotlights it in such a way that we go, we have got to get to work. We have got to stop. So we are literally watching something dying in front of our eyes that will affect millions of people in so many different ways, and we will basically ignore it because we don't see it. Put an image on television, the right image, and we are mobilized and we will make a change. And that's the most frightening aspect to me, is that some very important things can't get that visual component and they're forgotten.
I mean, I was really taken by that idea in all this, that we are in a world that is increasingly fragmented and isolated. And it's all about kind of the imagery that you were talking about that we put to it. And if you don't, I was thinking about the Chesapeake Bay too. I think you even mentioned that in the Chesapeake Bay came up in the documentary, if I recall correctly.
Well, I talk about the visual components, like
right.
Infrastructure has no relevance to us. A bridge falling down
right.
does.
Right. So, what are you just doing this? I'm just curious. I mean, because you're a very thoughtful guy. What are your thoughts about where this takes us? I mean, when you come out of Pollywood, and what happens to us now? I mean, how do we can the mediums that we work in, like you work in, can they somehow turn that back around so that the conversation can take place?
Well, I mean, that's a good question, you know, and I don't know that I have a good answer for it. I mean, all I can say is that all great inventions have an upside downside.
Right.
You know, the automobile is an amazing invention, but it did kill millions of people. You know, it did scar the landscape. It polluted the air. It has wreaked havoc on a lot of things, and it's still a great invention. And television is one of those inventions, but its effects are far more subtle. You don't see it in the same way. And so what happens is, you know, it's a very new invention. Is we at some point you have to say, all right, so what are the positives and what are the negatives and how do we correct some of things, or how do we just understand it better so we move ahead? Because it's not going to disappear. It's pervasive, and as it moves into the internet, it's seen in a lot of other forms. So how do we basically adapt to it in ways that we don't continue to be misinformed and ultimately not pay attention to some things we have to pay attention to?
Well, or the internet, you know, which is, destroying journalism as we speak. You know, I mean, journalism as we've known it. I mean, the newspaper, yeah.
Yeah, so each invention has its upside downside. So where does it all go? And it's part of our, you know, our adaptability, but we can't allow some of the more negative aspects of it to take over. Because the internet, which is amazing, is killing the newspaper. And some people would say, well, then so what? However, where does all the information come from?
Right.
You know, where are the reporters? Because, you know, the internet, you know, doesn't have these kinds of, you know, reporters, and they don't have the investment that the newspapers did. So where do we go from here? And that's, you know, look, this is the 21st century. There's a lot of things going on that we got to make sense out of. And so it's another one of the puzzles that has to be addressed.
We are in this huge transition time. That's one of the things I was thinking about watching this documentary. This is a period of I think we're in one of those great historical moments. We're just in the midst of it, so there's no way we know what's about to happen or what these changes are going to mean for us or how we're going to redefine them and what it's going to mean for our children who are going to really be the ones who define it, live through it, and create the next step out of what where we are now. And we just don't know. I mean, I think this whole – I mean, your friend David Simon is going to be wandering through the film festival. Yeah, I think he's testifying before Congress as we speak about the future of journalism. You know, and he's one of those people who's extremely worried about what happens, what you just described, about what how the mediums we're using, the internet, TV, are destroying the foundations of things that make us critique, think about, and get involved in our culture.
Yeah, and, you know, and it's a very serious issue of which no one has any answers for. But, you know, there are a disastrous downside to a lot of these things.
As an artist, does this make you more interested in the nonfiction form?
Well, yeah. I think both, Jed. I think because of, you know, certain changes in technology, it allows you to do documentaries on the fly that you couldn't do before.
Yeah.
So, you know, look, that's a positive in terms of how technology evolves. You can be all over the place with little cameras and covering things. So for me, I just love to be able to tell stories in different ways. I'm not locked into any one, you know, way of telling a story, but I'm equally as fascinated in both to make the short answer to it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing the crowd's reaction to your film. Which
I mean, what we're talking about sounds... You know, it's all serious, of which it is, but actually has a fair amount of humor that runs through it, as we always see how we function and understand and misunderstand. So there's an enjoyable nature that runs through the piece at the same time that we're talking about some serious issues.
Well, and it was also a completely different view. I mean, we all lived through news footage of the two conventions last year and the inauguration. And for me, one of the things that was so great was to actually see it through participants' eyes, you know, people who are there meeting with people and talking to people and thinking about issues and not caught up in, you know, whatever costume somebody's wearing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's and also I think there's that it seems like the audience really responds to, you know, John F. Kennedy's comments, you know, before he even became president in 59. About television and how it, in fact, had been manipulated, etc.
Here's what he actually said. Television is a medium that lends itself to manipulation, exploitation, and gimmicks. Political campaigns can actually be taken over by the public relations experts who tell the candidate not only how to use TV, but what to say, what to stand for, and what kind of person to be. This is John Kennedy in TV Guide, in 1959.
I mean, he's really incredibly insightful about the power of television and how it can be misused.
And I think that the people you have in this, there are some very funny scenes with David Crosby and Richard Schiff from West Wing and others. Barry Levinson, you couldn't direct a film that didn't have humor in it. It's just that even the way you ask your question sometimes, you draw this out.
You know, one of the fun parts was actually literally just wandering into these people. Like, I went into this building, and David Crosby was in there with Graham Nash and started talking to them. And the next thing you know, the Graham Nash goes out on the stage, and they ask him to turn on some lights, and we film him starting to sing, and then Crosby joins in. And
across some sacred valley, this is my country. This is my home, and I know when I sing these words that I am not alone. It's time to stop them in their tracks. It's time to take our country back. Put their ideas in a sack. Recycle for redemption. It's time to show them to the door. They won't be needed anymore. Tell them there will be no more war.
It's fun that let things evolve and happen, and so the music stuff just came about from just being in the right places.
It was very funny and very poignant. We just enjoyed it immensely last night. I'm looking forward to seeing you when you're back to Be More for a little bit, and encourage everyone on Sunday, May 10th, 5 p.m. at the Micah Brown Center to check out Pollywood. And Barry Levinson will be there with Matthew Modine. Thank you so much.
Great, thanks.
Don't go away. We're going to come right back. I'm going to continue our conversation with Jed Dietz about the great films you can see this weekend at the Maryland Film Festival. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This weekend is the Maryland Film Festival, a great yearly event when you get a chance to see some of the great independent films that most likely will not be coming to your local Hoyts and Regal cinemas. This year you have a lot to choose from social documentaries to great dramatic work featuring unknown actors and famous stars like Robin Williams. And joining me right now is Jed Dietz, director of the Maryland Film Festival, to help me learn about some of the many films coming to our city over the weekend. And as it is always, the film festival opens this year with a screening of some of the best short films being made today.
Yeah, we're the only festival I know of that opens with shorts. And it's this part of the film world that's just fantastic. And you really don't, normal audiences don't get a chance to see them.
There's even an Academy Award category now for shorts.
No, absolutely. But you know, where do you see them? I mean, they might come out in movie theaters in a batch.
Yeah, where do you see them?
Well, it's the big question. You have to come to film festivals.
On the internet. I don't know.
Well, there's a little bit, you know, iTunes is selling them, but of course you don't know what they are. So, you know, it's, you know, unlike the music where you do know what it is. So it's a real challenge, and it's a great part of the art form. Many great filmmakers have come out of the short form. I mean, Steven Spielberg and many have started by making shorts. And many continue to make shorts along with other things they do. We have, the great actor Matthew Modine that we were talking about with Barry Levinson has made a short that we're going to show at the festival called I Think I Thought. And
the first night?
We had one of his shorts a couple years ago in the first night, but this is one that is actually available on iTunes. I'll give him a plug. But you can see it at the festival. He's going to show it at the Filmmaker Tent Village and talk about making shorts. And frankly, I don't know why he made this film. It's a beautiful little film.
When's he doing that?
I forget. It's on the schedule, though. It's on the web, mdfilmfest.com. And I think Sunday is when he's doing it.
So the shorts, I'm looking forward to that night. I'm really, really looking forward to being there that night.
Yeah, and we have a bunch of great shorts program that are all on the web, and they're really fun.
And hosted by Bobcat Goldthwait. Goldthwait.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy, you know, started when he was 15 in Syracuse, New York, as a professional comedian doing stand-up in bars. He couldn't even buy a drink, but he could perform. And he's made three films now. John Waters picked one of his films called Sleeping Dogs Lie a couple years ago.
Yes.
This is a film starring an old friend of his, Robin Williams, as a in a completely non-Robin Williams role, as a nerdy poetry teacher in a public high school. And his son thinks he's a complete loser because his son's 17 and, you know, very worried about being a loser himself. And the whole thing then turns around. His whole world gets turned around. And this film is about – it's Bobcat. It's a celebrity in our midst exploring our current culture. And it's very funny, very dark, sometimes within the same scene. It's an amazing film. It'll come out this summer. I saw it at Sundance. And Bobcat's coming in to host opening night with a short film he made from – home movies of the Goldthwait family, which he'll show 7 minutes of those on opening night tonight. And then on Saturday, he hosts World's Greatest Dad.
And speaking of Saturday, Laura Lippman, one of my favorite people, and I think I would call her now America's greatest mystery writer. I think she's just – the latest book is amazing. She is hosting this year, and she's hosting the movie Funny Bones.
Yeah, this is something you were one of our first guest hosts,
right.
And we asked people who are not thought of as film people, although we cheat with you a little bit because you're an actor, but nobody thinks of Laura as a film person,
right.
Although one of her books has been optioned. But we asked some people who are not film people to pick a film that's meant a lot to them and then host a screening of it. And we've had politicians and athletes and radio hosts, and she picked this terrific movie by Peter Chelsom. Now, Peter Chelsom started as a small independent filmmaker in England. He made a wonderful movie called Hear My Song this was his second movie. He has most recently made Hannah Montana, the movie. So I'm defying anybody to find another movie that brings together Oliver Platt, Jerry Lewis, and Peter Chelsom. And Laura has done it. And
Oliver Reed is in this movie too.
Yeah. And I asked Laura why, and she'll talk about why she chose this movie. But the thing she said to me that won my heart immediately was she said, this is the only movie I've ever seen in which I literally didn't know what was going to happen next.
I'm looking forward to seeing this. That's going to be a great night. That's Saturday, 2 o'clock. Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock at the Charles Theater. That's taking place then. So what else has really kind of grabbed you? I haven't seen all these films, so I can't.
Well, I can talk about it. There's so many things, and I know you've done a great series on a lot of the nonfiction films, the documentary films, and we were just talking to Levinson about one he's done. There are also some wonderful feature films. There's this whole group of new filmmakers. We have three of them here, Joe Swanberg and Rai Russo-Young and Chris Swanberg, who have made fiction films, very intimate films. They're in their 20s. It's about sort of issues of their lives. These are people who started making films to make films. They had no ambition to get big distribution. They're now starting to get distribution. Some of this group's films are now being picked up by distributors. Lynn Shelton's new film, Hump Day, is at Cannes. And these are wonderful films, all made possible by this new technology of small cameras and really high-powered and good digital cameras.
And the closing night.
The closing night is
The Hurt Locker.
Yeah, is a major piece of filmmaking from a major film director, a woman named Catherine Bigelow, who has been making movies for quite a while. She's a trained artist, is her background. And she made a movie with Jamie Lee Curtis called Blue Steel. She made a movie with Patrick Swayze and Keanu Reeves called Point Break.
Right.
She made a great movie with Ralph Fiennes called Strange Days. She's sort of been tagged amazingly as a woman making action films. I mean, she's really sort of busted through all the Hollywood preconceptions about what women.
That's right. She directed some Homicide episodes.
Yes, she did. That's exactly right. She's been in Baltimore directing Homicide, and she's a very visceral, very visual filmmaker, which would take you back to her art background. This is a story based on a piece of journalism by the screenwriter, Mark Boll, who was embedded with a very special army unit in Iraq. And these are one of these units that what they do every day when they get up is go and defuse IEDs, defuse bombs, wherever they are, whether they're under a building, they're in a car, hidden in some corpse, it doesn't matter. They are reported to go to places where one of these things might be, and they have a whole protocol for how they seal off the area because, of course, they're insurgent sniper fire often getting at them. And then one guy is walked in within several hundred yards. At several hundred yards, he puts on a 140-pound Kevlar suit, and he alone continues walking toward the IED. And then he diffuses it. And he does this 12, 15 times a day. And what this film is about, it's not per se a war film. What it's about is the addiction of having a skill that's that rare and leading, going through a day where you're doing something at such a high tension level. And how do you do that and have anything remotely like a normal life? And how do you relate to normal people? And this is a story out of Faulkner and Hemingway, and it's based on Mark Boll's reporting. It is fiction, but it's based on a true story. Mm-hmm. And both Catherine and Mark Boll will be here, and Anne Hornaday is going to interview them after the film.
And Ralph Fiennes is in this movie as well.
Yes, and Guy Pearce. It's really a wonderful cast, and this young guy Jeremy Renner, who plays the lead character, is going to be a major movie star. He's really something in this movie.
There's another film happening on Friday and Saturday, the Charles Theater on Friday at 12:30 and Saturday at 2 o'clock at the Micah Brown Center, that I saw, and we interviewed the filmmaker, May Eskander's film Garbage Dreams, which was an amazing movie. It was done with, it's about the Zabalin, these community of garbage workers in Cairo. And she made a film that, it's a documentary, but it's so deeply human and has such drama within it, in terms of the people's lives who live in this garbage dump neighborhood, who travel to Europe to learn more and are fighting this international corporation trying to save their way of life, but and it's built around these three young men and their families. It's just she's a young filmmaker, and I'm just really one of the things I was telling you about was the excitement I had in watching the film was the idea about how young she was, the filmmaker herself, and this kind of new batch of young filmmakers coming up.
Well, there's another one about a Senegalese singer named Youssou N'Dour, made also by a
great singer. I love Youssou N'Dour stuff.
By a first-time filmmaker, and this is a guy who is a legend all through Africa, starting in Senegal. He has a nightclub in Dakar, but he was, named by Time as one of the 100 most influential people on the planet. Has done a lot of stuff with Western songwriters. Yep. After 9/11, he set out to make an album. He's Sufi Muslim. And he set out to make an album about Islam that he thought would capture it back from the terrorists and allow the West, who were not Muslim, to understand the great spiritual quality of Islam. And he made this album called Egypt, an honored, wonderful album.
It's a great album.
And immediately, great friends of his in Senegal. One of the great pilgrimages in the Muslim world happens in Touba in Senegal. A million people. And you'll see scenes in the movie of this thing. A million people come in. I'd never even heard of the city. And it has that kind of a pilgrimage. So he gets people in his own country who adore him, accuse him of being blasphemous. The album gets highly criticized. And this film, you see him. Not only do you get to see him perform, which is a rare treat, but you see him trying to deal with this and walk this album through this navigation to let people understand that what he understands about the spiritual world that he thinks is at the base of Islam.
What's the name of the film again?
It's called it's Youssou N'Dour.
It's called Youssou N'Dour. Yeah. It's right here, Youssou N'Dour. It's Saturday, May 9th at 6:30 at the Charles.
And it's also, this is a filmmaker, I think this is her first film. She assisted Mike Nichols on one of his films and just went off and made this film. And she's now about to make another film on the great pilgrimage to Touba.
All right. Where else are we going to go here before we...
Well, how about ratcheting all the way back to 1929 and seeing a film called Man with a Movie Camera made by a revolutionary filmmaker, a guy named Ziga Vertov, who to this day, this film in the film community is studied by everybody who studies film, especially cinematographers. And it was banned in Stalinist Russia. It's a silent film made in 1929. The Alloy Orchestra composed a score for it in 1995 that itself became legendary off of Vertov's notes that he left for the film. It's on several DVDs. They have not been able to perform live with the film because no print existed. They finally found a print. I think there was one at the Eastman House, and they didn't like letting it out because it was so rare. They found a print at the Gosfilmfond archives in Russia. They bought it. They performed it for the first time in 12 years on April 9th in St. Petersburg. The second time they will perform it, the first time in North America in 12 years, will be in Baltimore on Sunday morning.
You bring them down here a lot. Are they here every year?
They've been here a number of years. We've done a lot of silence with various kinds of musical accompaniment. But
this is, you've put together, I mean, as usual, you kind of look at these films all year and you go out to Sundance and see what's there and figure out what needs to come here. And
yeah, in Toronto and I mean, we really go all over. I mean, these 130 films, 80 shorts and 50 feature-length films, really come from all over the world. I mean, we have two Korean films. We have a film from Rwanda.
Which we interviewed the director for that film as well.
Yeah. Slovakia. I mean, the world is just bursting open, as you were pointing out, with young filmmakers from all over. And our programmers, Eric Hatch and Skizizic, have culled through thousands of films that they have seen at filmmakers, that come in from other filmmakers, that come in through just blind submission. And it's an amazing process to go through. We have a great committee of people who look at films, and every film is delivered to this Baltimore audience with huge passion behind it.
There's a movie I want to see. One of the films I want to see is the one you have Nina Simone, La Légende. It looks marvelous.
It's also very rare. I mean, Ian MacKaye, who's a famous punk rock musician, was approached by one of our programmers, Eric Hatch, to to be a guest host, and he chose this Nina Simone film.
Before we tell people again how they come for the rest of the weekend and see all these incredible films that you're doing that are at the Maryland Film Festival, there's a unique way you do this. I mean, you don't – Maryland Film Festival is unlike other film festivals. A, the shorts is one reason, as we talked about earlier. The other is you don't give out awards. This is not like best of. You have a very different philosophy about how you approach the world of film festivals.
Yeah, we don't categorize films, so you won't see anything called world cinema or documentary or, I mean, we just, you know, program them and schedule them as best we can in the right spaces. And we don't have a competition. So it gives the filmmakers a chance really to come here and enjoy each other's work, celebrate the art form for just a minute. It's a business. It is show business, but it gives them a chance to, and audiences to really enjoy what they've done.
So, starting tonight, May the 7th, through Sunday, May 10th, tickets are still available.
Yep. You can go on the web until 11:30 tonight, and then at the Tent Village across the street from the Charles, starting tomorrow morning.
So, mdfilmfest.org.
Org or com.
Mm-hmm. You can go and buy tickets, or you can come right down to the Charles Theater.
And you'll see on the website the schedule, and then if you double-click on any title, you'll get the full program description and a picture of the title.
And come see as many films as you can. It's always a treat. There'll be interesting discussions, phenomenal films, and plenty of good places to eat all around the film festival.
Indeed.
Spend the day. Jed Dietz, once again, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining me today, and I hope you'll get a chance to enjoy the Maryland Film Festival this weekend. It's a really wonderful event, and our city and region is really lucky to have it here. So please support it by taking time to see a film or two. Just visit mdfilmfest.org to see the full schedule and descriptions of all the films that are showing. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite delves into the hidden phenomena, shadowy characters, undisclosed locations, and other mysteries in Baltimore. It's the Secrets issue, available now at over 800 locations around the region and online at urbanitebaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. And we want to say thanks to Rick Isaac and Nick Sostrom at Clean Cuts for their help in engineering. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, and Jackson Hubel. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. If you hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.